from the Netherlands. This is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, underground fungal networks pulsating with nutrients, storing mountains of carbon.
Just an enormous underground nutrient system below our feet that's just pulsating with carbon and nutrients and consistently flowing. I think that's what people don't really understand, is just how dynamic and fluid the nutrients are inside these networks.
On Lebanese hilltops, ancient cedars grow against all odds.
This is a cedrus seedling, Cedrus libani. We find it in most forests in Lebanon, but we use it mainly for reforestation. This is from a seed we have germinated here inside the lab. Now this seedling is ready to be put back in its natural habitat.
And looking back at a cosmic event of colossal proportions that rippled space-time.
It was an amazing event in the history of astrophysics, I would say. It was a new era in astrophysics where you're combining gravitational waves, physics with electromagnetic radiation across the electromagnetic spectrum, from radio all the way to high energies.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm Dave Kattenberg. Before launching in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. It's a vast living web beneath our feet, a tangled underground network of microscopic tubes weaving through the soil, pulsating with nutrients, tying the roots of trees and other plants into networks that extend over square kilometers. Mycorrhizal fungi, they're called. Most plants rely on them entirely. In exchange for plant sugars, mycorrhizal fungi provide phosphorus and nitrogen, but they do more than just feed plants. They cycle carbon from atmosphere to soil, helping to regulate Earth's climate. Underground fungi face a host of threats from above. Soil scientists have come together to protect fungal networks and are calling on citizens to do the same. Toby Kears is the founder of SPUN, the Society for the Protection of Underground Networks. I spoke to Toby Kears at her lab in Leiden in the Netherlands.
So I co-founded SPUN, which stands for the Society for the Protection of Underground Networks. And it's a nonprofit to map and protect the Earth's underground fungal networks.
And what are these underground fungal networks?
So when we talk about underground fungal networks, we're talking about mycorrhizal fungi. And mycorrhizal fungi are a class of organisms that form a symbiosis with plant roots. And they forage in the soil for phosphorus and nitrogen, and then they exchange these resources for carbon from the host plant. So basically, plants are covered with these fungal networks, and they're feeding them carbon that they fix from the atmosphere, and they feed it to arbuscular mycorrhizae in the form of sugars and fats. And so the fungi can't live without this carbon, and so they rely completely on their carbon source from these roots. And in exchange, they're providing phosphorus and nitrogen that allow the plants to grow big and healthy.
And you said arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. What's the distinction?
Yeah, so we have two major classes of mycorrhizae, and one is called arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. And they're called arbuscular because they form these beautiful tree-like structures inside a plant root cell. So the fungus actually penetrates into the cell and forms this beautiful structure that almost looks like a mini tree. And that's where the site of nutrient exchange happens, carbon for phosphorus or nitrogen. And this is the type of fungi that really, they're what we call obligate biotrophs. That means they depend completely on plants for all of their carbon. And so as a result, they're fed an enormous amount of carbon, and they actually help create a large carbon sink underground. They help carbon accumulate underground. So that's one of the major types of these mycorrhizal fungi. The other are what we call ectomycorrhizal fungi. Ectomycorrhizal fungi are interesting because they never penetrate into the plant cell, but they grow a beautiful structure on the outside of the host roots. And again, plants are feeding carbon to them, and the fungus is growing out into the soil and collecting nitrogen and sometimes phosphorus and exchanging it. And these types of networks tend to be associated with conifers, so like our fir trees and our pine trees, whereas the arbuscular type tend to be associated more with deciduous trees that lose their leaves, let's say. That's a good way to think about it, or grasslands, shrubs. But those are just broad categories. Within that, there's always interesting exceptions.
Could either of them exist without the other? Do the trees require the mycorrhizal fungi, and do the mycorrhizal fungi require the trees?
That's a great question. So for the arbuscular mycorrhizae, they do. They really require this symbiosis to be a functioning organism and actually reproduce. They need to have this carbon from the plant. The ectomycorrhizae, they can survive for longer amounts of time. They can make mushrooms, but still they get fed an enormous amount of carbon from plant roots. And if we think about the other question that you asked, can plants survive without mycorrhizal fungi? That's a great question because it really takes us back to the root of the symbiosis. So plants basically evolved on land because of a symbiosis with fungal partners. So if we go way back in history, you know, some 400 million years ago, plants were largely confined to an aquatic environment. And it wasn't until they made this partnership with fungi that they started to be able to colonize a terrestrial habitat. So you can almost think of this partnership leading to this giant, you know, explosion of land plants. It was through this partnership that plants could start to get nutrients from that hardy rock, not even soil yet, but that's what the terrestrial earth was made of a long, long time ago. So this partnership allowed plants to move from an aquatic environment to land. And so actually, you know, people that study the symbiosis, they tend to think of the fungi as really the core component of plant biodiversity, that it's the fungi that are actually farming the plants. So it kind of changes your whole worldview when you realize just how important these fungi are for driving plant survival and colonization of the earth.
And their total biomass is huge. Has anybody estimated the total mass of fungal networks beneath the surface of the soil?
Yeah, so people have been trying to get at these ideas of how massive are these fungal networks. And again, it really varies on the habitat that you're looking at. But some work has shown that anywhere from 30 to 50% of the living biomass of soils can be made up of these fungal networks. So just to give you an idea of how massive that is, if you're to take, let's say, a hectare of grassland and lay out all of the fungal network in that hectare is one long line, it would be equivalent to about 12 million lengths of the Amazon River in one hectare of grassland. So again, just an enormous underground nutrient system below our feet that's just pulsating with carbon and nutrients and consistently flowing. I think that's what people don't really understand, is just how dynamic and fluid the nutrients are inside these networks. So our lab is really trying to focus on these flows and understand how these flows of nutrients are controlled by fungi underground.
And you can actually see the flow.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what we've been doing in collaboration with ELMOF, which is a physics institute here in the Netherlands, is we've developed tools to actually be able to look at the flows inside these networks and start quantifying how fast they move, when they change directions. You know, how does this bidirectional movement happen inside these networks? And when I mean bidirectional, what I need you to picture is a river that's floating two directions simultaneously. So the north side of the river would be flowing one way and the south side of the river would be flowing another, but no barrier in between it. So how do these flows happen? How did they evolve? And how are they under fungal control?
I mean, how do they happen?
Yeah, that's exactly it's surprising even to me that this could be the most ubiquitous and probably the most important symbiosis on Earth, and we still really don't understand the flow dynamics. So it's quite an open field right now, trying to understand the biophysics of how these flows are controlled underground. We know that there are molecular motors that are contributing to these flows along the inside of what we call the fungal hyphae. So those are the long tubes of fungi. So molecular motors are very small motors that move nutrients around. And you can see, when you study these flows, you can see how nutrients kind of start to attach to almost to the sides of the wall and move in different directions. So we know that molecular motors play a role, moving in different directions at the same time. We also think that there's a very, very important contribution of pressure-driven flows. And that's really what we're trying to understand now, is that the cytoplasmic contents inside these networks, that liquid, is under a lot of pressure. And we think that the fungi might be able to change the direction of those flows by changing the pressure inside those tubes. You have to remember, these are microscopic rivers of nutrients, and they're flowing really fast. So inside a fungal network, it would feel like you are moving about 50 kilometers an hour, 30 to 50 kilometers an hour. But that's just the average speed. They can get up to speeds that are really, really quite high. So we talk about speeds of about 100 microns per second, right? It's hard to imagine what it's like to be inside a fungal network. But basically, it feels like you're moving inside a pretty steady moving car, I would say.
And they're vast. I mean, spatially, what kind of, and some of these guys are, I mean, they're individuals. These are individual organisms.
You're asking all the hard questions, right? I mean, defining an individual in these fungal networks is incredibly difficult. Because
I mean, they're continuous.
They can be continuous, exactly. They can be continuous for kilometers. The issue is that they have a very different genetic system than humans, let's say, which are quite easy to define genetically. They've got multiple nuclei inside their networks that can be different. So their genomes are not necessarily inside that network. These nuclear contents that are flowing and fill up the spores, which are the reproductive units, are not always exactly the same. So what is an individual if it's not the exact same genetic makeup? For example, you can take two different strains within the same species, grow them together, and sometimes they fuse. They fuse these bridges and they start sharing nuclei. They start sharing resources. Other times you can grow them and they can be a little bit, you know, genetically different. And instead of forming bridges and sharing nutrients, there's conflict. And they start growing and competing to try to get resources to feed to the roots. So I think we're at this point in science right now where we're really trying to understand, what is an individual, and when do you see fusion between individuals, and when do you see that they are competitors? And even that question we don't know yet. We know that, for example, they can sense different resource gradients. They can change their growth strategy depending on whether there's high or low nutrients. They change their growth strategy depending on how many different plant partners are available or how many fungal competitors that they're up against. This is all ways that they process information that allows them to evolve strategies that basically optimize those conditions for trade. So we know this because we've developed really high-resolution techniques that allow us to follow these nutrient streams across the fungal network. We see that the fungi are actually very good at taking resources from where they're very readily available and then moving them across the network to places where they're less available and the plant is willing to pay more for them. So where resources are low, they are getting more carbon in return from the plant. And so these are the kinds of experiments that we set up, is trying to understand these strategies. How do they sense where they can make these better trade deals? And you can imagine, I mean, these fungi have been under natural selection for hundreds of millions of years. It's not surprising that they would have evolved strategies that allow them to optimize their trading patterns.
Show me a video.
Okay, so I'm opening up a video right now of some of the dynamics that we're seeing inside these networks. What surprised people the most is that this is in real time, right? These are videos that are not sped up. This is actually what's happening below our feet. And so it's a very, very fast, dynamic movement. And you can see that these flows are going two different directions. And not only are they going two different directions, but sometimes the fungi will change the direction of the overall flow and have it go in a completely different direction. And so really what we're trying to do, you can see now, it looks like a living river, but how can a river have so many different dynamics at once, where you can have the river banks flowing in two different directions simultaneously?
How do you map them?
Okay.
Because you've actually mapped networks in various places in the Netherlands and elsewhere. Where have you actually mapped networks of mycorrhizal fungi?
So when we talk about mapping mycorrhizal fungi, what we're talking about is mapping the biodiversity patterns, which fungi are where and what habitats are they associated with. So this project that we have with SPUN is trying to get the first global resolution of these patterns underground. There's been a long history of mycology globally, right? People recognize that fungi, you know, they're different organisms. But a lot of the work so far has really been focused on the mushrooms, the reproductive part of the fungi. The part that stick up, the part we can eat or not eat, these are the mushrooms that have captivated the attention of the public for so long. What we're trying to have people understand is that is just the tip of the iceberg, right? That is the tiniest little ephemeral part of the fungi that comes up briefly and disappears, usually just as fast. But if we were to be able to see underground, we would see a whole different world. It's a world full of these nutrient rivers that are just pulsating with carbon and phosphorus and nitrogen, and they're connecting plant roots. And those are the networks that we're trying to map right now and understand what is the biodiversity, what is the distribution of these fungal networks, and is that changing under climate change? You know, these are ecosystem engineers. I think most people would agree now that if we lost the fungi, the soil would not stick together. It would just start washing away. Fungi are the seam that hold ecosystems together. And yet we don't know who is where. And so we've started this project as the first attempt to get a global picture of where these fungi are. In the next 18 months, we're trying to gather about 10,000 samples. And so it's a massive effort to put these fungi on the map, the way that we have maps of global vegetation or ocean currents, right? These are all systems that we have started to map. Even the stars we have better maps of than global fungi underground. And this is just key. It's just shocking to me that we haven't developed these maps, considering how important they are for our climate, how important they are for plants and therefore for animals, all surviving above ground, and yet to have no idea of how these networks connect ecosystems across the earth is shocking to me.
And you said in the beginning, they store vast amounts of carbon.
Exactly. So we're still working on refining these estimates, right? These are very, very hard estimates to get. And, you know, because we're scientists, every number that we say we want to be triple check and double check and check again. And the latest estimates, well, I guess the estimates coming out in the early 2000s were about 5 billion tons of carbon, of CO2, are flowing from plants to underground fungal networks. But that's 5 billion tons of CO2 per year is a huge amount of carbon.
And that's just the flow. I mean, the amount that's actually cumulatively being stored must be orders of magnitude higher than that.
It's very hard to say. I mean, you have to remember that carbon it's a cycle. It's a very dynamic process. So a lot of carbon goes below ground, and then the fungi respire carbon. Carbon is also released. And so we're really trying to understand about what is the contribution of mycorrhizal networks to carbon sequestration underground. And that's, you know, that's a big field of study. There's a lot of really innovative scientists that are working on this question. It's a really exciting time to be studying underground fungal networks and their contribution to climate, and asking, you know, what is their role, and what happens if we continue on this trajectory of destroying fungal networks? That's what we're worried about. You know, when you till soil, when you release that carbon from these networks, it can be potentially really dangerous, and can lead to tipping points in terms of increases in CO2, and then therefore increasing temperatures and extreme climates. And so we're really advocating for better science that's focused on this underground climate component that has been, I think, really underappreciated in both climate and conservation agendas.
In the news, we're always hearing about the great forests, the rainforest, the Amazon, all the vegetation above ground constitutes an enormous pool of carbon. But, you know, in point of fact, carbon pools beneath the soil or in the soil are larger than, if I'm not mistaken, there's more carbon stored in the soil than there is carbon in above ground vegetation.
Yeah, so 75% of terrestrial carbon is stored underground. And so how this cannot be, you know, the laser sharp focus of the climate agenda is surprising. And I think scientists have been studying this and sort of talking to each other for decades, right? I think the researchers really know what's going on, but getting that out to the public, to policymakers, that underground ecosystems are incredibly important for protecting our climate. And so how do we do that, right? I think that what we're seeing now is a real shift in consciousness, where people are starting to appreciate the biodiversity and the role that underground ecosystems play in today's climate. And that's why we need to start really working on the science and providing the data to show exactly how much, not only how much carbon, you know, I think that kind of compresses the problem, right? It really short circuits the problem. I think we're talking about whole systems, right? These are living systems that support a huge, not only store a huge amount of carbon, but support a huge amount of biodiversity below ground, right? 25% of all species live below ground. It's a huge number when we talk about overall biodiversity. And these fungal networks, they support that biodiversity. They're like the coral reefs of the soil. They're in these soil systems, which people are taking for granted, right? We're experiencing things on Earth that the fungi haven't necessarily experienced before. And that has a lot to do with chemical pollution and with fungicides and things that they've never been exposed to before. So on one hand, yes, they're robust. But on the other hand, the way that we treat our soil is inexcusable. And I think when we talk about, well, what's happening to the fungi, we have to start cataloging what we're losing, right? We have no idea what's even out there, so we don't even know what we're losing, and that's what worries me.
Have you been to places and studied places, Toby Kears, where you've seen that there are not a lot of mycorrhizal fungi? There's soils where the fungi are absent or stressed.
Of course. Yes, so we travel to ecosystems that would break your heart. So clear cuts, right? Forest clear cuts, where forests are cut and then sometimes the stumps are ripped from the ground. There's a really growing, a large and growing body of research that's showing just how negative deforestation can be for fungal networks. And sometimes it takes decades for these networks to recover. Fire systems, you know, there's some fungi that are amazing that are able to come right back after a fire system. But these symbiotic mycorrhizal networks are not one of those types of fungi, and they take a very long time to come back. And again, you know, decades can go by, and then still low levels of diversity, low levels of abundance. Agricultural systems, especially conventional agricultural systems, where, you know, there's tillage, there's pesticides, there's fungicides. You know, eventually there's just not much soil life left. in these agricultural systems. And it can be brought back, right? There's a hope story here, right? This is not just about these fungi getting destroyed and never being replaced. That's what's so amazing. It takes a long time, but you can grow healthy soils back. It's just that the rate at which we are destroying soils, I think the latest UN numbers say that 90% of soils will be degraded by 2050, right? 2050, I can picture 2050. That's very soon. And so that's what we have to worry about. Not the fact that it's irreversible, but that the lands are going to be degraded so much, we're going to lose so much biodiversity, that how can we rely on them as levers in helping us get out of this whole climate scenario that we're heading for so fast. So not only we're not taking care of the fungi, but we're not using the same levels of innovation that we could be in terms of partnering with fungi to help us, approach some of our biggest climate issues.
And how would we do that?
Well, that's what we're trying to advocate for, is getting more scientists on board with understanding how we can partner with fungi to help with change the climate agenda. What does it look like to have a really healthy, biodiverse underground ecosystem? And how can we replicate that? How can we protect the ecosystems that are already there? If we conserve land above ground, does that necessarily, are the management strategies that we are using to, let's say, protect an amphibian that may be having falling population numbers, are those the same strategies that we would use for an endemic fungal network? We can't answer those questions yet, right? We may know how to protect a habitat for an amphibian, but we don't know how to protect a habitat yet for an endemic fungal network. And so there's just a lot of research that can be done. And also there's a lot that can be done with public awareness, right? Don't leave your soil bare, right? That's a really, really, really bad thing for fungal networks. Advocate for green roofs in cities. A lot of people don't know, but these fungal networks, they spread through spores aerially. They're in the air, the spores, right? And so if they can have some kind of corridor of green through cities, this helps them survive. This helps them form healthy networks within the urban environment themselves, is having green spaces. So there's people can talk about underground ecosystems the way that they talk about Amazon forests and coral reefs, right? They can start to appreciate the organisms that live down there. And I think to be able to do that, they need to understand, they need to start being able to visualize what is under our feet. And again, that's where science can help, right? There's some really beautiful techniques that are being developed now. For example, 3D x-rays of plant fungal systems. So you actually can see what this looks like in a 3D x-ray. You can start seeing underground. And I think the public perception is going to shift as soon as they see these as living systems, the way that you see an ocean body, for example. They're just as important. It's just that they've been so invisible to the world. And we as humans rely so much on our sense of vision to understand systems. We need to start relying on different senses, I think, to appreciate the underground.
Toby Kears is a professor in the Faculty of Science, Ecology, and Evolution at the Free University of Amsterdam. She's also the founder of a group called SPUN, the Society for the Protection of Underground Networks. Read more about SPUN and Toby Kears' research at greenplanetmonitor.net. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. If you're appreciating what you're hearing, go to greenplanetmonitor.net and subscribe or donate, or both. With your generous help, we'll keep delivering stories about global ecology, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. The cedar is Lebanon's national symbol. It's on its flag, its banknotes, a source of identity and pride. But Lebanon's renowned cedar forests are not what they used to be, once a continuous carpet running up and down Lebanon's mountainous spine. These splendid forests of cedar, pine, and spruce have been exploited since the days of the ancient Phoenicians, who built ships out of them. The Egyptians used cedar in their mummies. The Ottomans, British, and French took their turn, exploiting Lebanon's forest wealth. Today, all that remains of Lebanon's vast cedar forests are a dozen fragmented islands threatened by livestock grazing and climate change. The key to restoring them is their genetic diversity. That's precisely what a Lebanese NGO called Juzur Lubnan, Lebanon Roots, has in mind. Here's a story about that. I'm in a taxi heading into the hills above Beirut. I'm going to the genetics lab and seed bank where Lebanon's famous cedars are being studied and restored.
About cedars, what's happening?
Dr. Magna Daguerre-Karat is a plant geneticist here at St. Joseph University on a pine-covered campus gazing down on coastal urban sprawl. She's also the co-founder of a Lebanese NGO called Juzur Lubnan, Lebanon Roots. Tell me about what you're doing here. You're studying the genetics of cedars.
Yes, cedars and also juniper.
Cedrus Lebani is their logo, but restoration of forest ecosystems is what Juzur Lubnan's project is all about. High and low elevation stands of pine, spruce, juniper, apple, pear, and almond, and the animals that spread their seeds, are what Dr. Karat and her colleagues aim to recreate.
Deforestation is not just about planting cedars or one kind of tree. We would like to have a forest, and forest is not composed of one single species. So we are trying to recreate the community that was living in these mountains.
Once a continuous carpet up and down its mountainous spine, Lebanon's forests have been exploited since the days of the Phoenicians. Today, all that remains are a dozen fragmented islands, threatened by livestock grazing and climate change. The key to restoring them is their genetic diversity.
We believe that a population of trees that had a high genetic diversity, that means that it has also a high potential to adapt to whatever change will occur in the environment. We can use the most powerful genotypes that are prone to be more resistant to climate change in the field, in our deforestation campaign.
Dr. Karat takes me to her lab, where she and her students are pinpointing the DNA sequences that make native Cedrus Lebani so different from its Cypriot, Italian, North African, and Himalayan cousins, and so adapted to Lebanon's climate.
So we bring the leaves, and we just bring them here with the liquid nitrogen. We extract DNA, and then we amplify this DNA. We are targeting this sequence.
Dr. Karat's lab is also identifying mammals like red fox, gray wolf, and golden jackal that spread seeds, and that will have to be reintroduced if restored ecosystems are to function. So will microbe-rich soils Dr. Karat and her students are digging up in biodiverse islands up and down the country. Genetics work complete, they'll set out to rebuild forest ecosystems from the ground up, reconnecting them so genes can flow, helping trees migrate to higher, cooler elevations where their cones are adapted to release seeds.
Cedars are trying to cope by living at higher altitude, by migrating, but we have what we call the migration lag, because the trees cannot move very fast like animals do. So that's why we are doing the assisted migration. We are helping cedars to grow higher in altitude. So this is our seed bank.
And it's kind of a little chilly in here.
Hello.
Dr. Karat takes me to a seed bank run by her students in partnership with the NGO Juzur Lubnan. Anthony is one of them.
We do a process called ex situ conservation, ex situ. We take samples, seeds or plant parts, and we conserve them outside of their natural habitat, meaning in seed banks or in labs such as this one.
The first step is cleaning the seeds. Dozens are either stored or germinated to learn how they sprout best.
This is a Cedrus seedling, Cedrus libani. We find it in most forests in Lebanon, but we use it mainly for reforestation. Exactly. This is from a seed we have germinated here inside the lab. Now this seedling is ready to be put back in its natural habitat.
Optimal germination protocols in hand, Juzur Lubnan is recruiting commercial nurseries to grow seedlings in the thousands. Juzur Lubnan buys them and plants them up in the mountains. Green thumbs around the world are being invited to adopt a cedar online. 40,000 have been planted over the past 4 years with support from the European Union. Where are we going?
To the top of the mountains in Ain Majdalain.
Tony Shaheen manages Juzur Lubnan's forest restoration project. Above the town of Jizin, Tony tends a hillside of cedar and pine seedlings. A guard post sits on this windy ridge. We're in South Lebanon, Hezbollah country. Today, their post is deserted. So and is this guard post up here, this is the Hezbollah's?
It's like a station, a check. And actually we are friends because they help us in this project.
Tony and the guys from Hezbollah get along. Tense questions out of the way, Hezbollah forces watch over seedlings now and plant some themselves.
Here we are in the plantation site, in the second part. So here you can see the planted seedlings protected with individual fence.
Before seedlings could be planted, the Lebanese army had to be called in to remove landmines from Lebanon's 15-year civil war and Israel's 2006 invasion of South Lebanon. Doing so involved removing a meter of topsoil. Now this terrain has been cleared of mines. I'm presuming that we can walk freely down here.
Yes, here you can walk. Here it's safe. You can walk.
Seedlings on demined land had a tough time, continually buried by rubble from mine-cleared topsoil. But most are doing well. How are these seedlings doing? This looks like it's prospering.
We are happy that the cedar seedlings are growing here. So here are growing because we are irrigating them. We have almost 90% of survival rate of all species.
Not surprisingly, the seedlings that do best have the best genetics.
You can find seed trees starting 1,200 meters till 2,000 meters. Here we are at around 1,500 meters. So the seed sores are from the same altitude. So they can grow, they can adapt fast and in a healthy way.
Lebanon's cedars are a source of pride for Tony Shaheen. The cedar is the national symbol of Lebanon.
Yes, but because you can find it on the flag, on the money notes, on the passport. You can find it anywhere.
So this is a selling point when you talk to local villagers and municipal leaders and the members of Hezbollah who are patrolling this area, and you tell them you're trying to reforest the area with cedars. Suddenly, it's something that touches their heart.
Yes,
I would
yes.
think. What kind of reaction do you get?
Wow, we need to help. We need. Can you give me some trees to plant them around my house, around my station, around my anything? So they want to help.
The Lebanese people are proud of their famous cedars. They're also famously fractious. Driving back to Beirut, Tony describes the challenge of securing buy-in for his forest work among key stakeholders in Shia, Sunni, Druze, and Christian communities.
In my work, I had to visit all the villages in Lebanon, south, north, Mecca, and Beirut, and everywhere. So
you're talking to Shia, you're talking to Sunnis.
To Shia, to Sunna, to Durzi, to to Christian
Hezbollah.
It's different when I talk with Jazim Meir, because he's of Tehran, he's Shiite, he has his own accent, and he talked about religion, about God, about Quran. You have to respect, you have to say, yes, you are right.
In the course of your conversation, yes, you spoke about all these things.
Yes, yes. Also like that, he talked about political situation in Lebanon. But my aim is was talk about a new project. About reforestation.
For Tony Shaheen, the cultural diversity of the Lebanese people and the genetic diversity of their forests go hand in hand. Both are a source of strength.
All people are living in this ecosystem. And if the ecosystem is damaged, all will be affected by this damage. So we cannot take part or cannot be against or with. We have all be with ecosystem and helping the ecosystem.
For more information about Lebanon's endangered cedars and the work of Juzur Lubnan, Lebanon Roots, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. For $5 or more, you'll be helping to make this news package happen. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Back in 2017, astronomers feasted their eyes and focused their instruments on something Albert Einstein predicted, but no one had ever actually observed. 130 million light years away, a pair of super-dense neutron stars had collided with each other, back when dinosaurs were roaming the Earth, sending out pulses of electromagnetic signals and gravitational waves rippling the fabric of space-time. I spoke with Samar Safi Harb about the event, named after the date it was observed, GW170817. Safi Harb is a professor of physics and astronomy and a Canada research chair on extreme astrophysics at the University of Manitoba. Can you tell me what was this collision all about that everybody was talking about and astonished the astrophysics world? Like, what actually happened?
Right, so it was an amazing event in the history of astrophysics, I would say. So the event was referred to as GW170817, because that's the date. It was an event that was detected first by LIGO, which is a gravitational waves detector. And I'm sure you've heard of LIGO big time in the news. Recently, they won the Nobel Prize. Prior to that event, in fact, for their discovery of the very first discovery of gravitational waves from merging black holes. So when two black holes merge, then you expect to see these gravitational waves, which result from the distortion of or ripples in space-time that have been predicted by Einstein more than a century ago now. So that was the very first direct detection of gravitational waves from merging black holes that was predicted by Einstein 100 years ago. Now, what happened in August was the very first detection of gravitational waves from merging neutron stars instead of black holes. And that was so exciting for the community because it was followed up by some 70 telescopes across the world that detected also light, not just gravitational waves from that event. So it was a new era in astrophysics where you're combining gravitational waves physics with electromagnetic radiation across the electromagnetic spectrum, from radio all the way to high energies.
So if one had been standing at a comfortable distance away from these two neutron stars and were to actually have been able to see them, what would they have been doing before they collided with each other?
Right. So this is precisely what LIGO detected, is they would be spiraling in. There will be gravitational waves basically detected because of the ripples in space-time, because these are very strong gravity objects. A neutron star is the result of the collapse of a massive star. So stars about 10 times the mass of the sun or heavier than that will eventually die in explosions, and they make objects that we call neutron stars. These are primarily made of neutrons under extreme densities, and they have the size of a city like Winnipeg, but they are a bit more massive than the sun, so they are extremely dense objects. So when you get two of these actually spiraling in together, there's extreme gravities, extreme temperatures, extreme magnetic fields being bumped into each other, it's going to be a catastrophic event. But also in the process, because of the ripples in space-time, they emit the gravitational waves. And that's what was first detected by LIGO. So LIGO told us there is something happening out there. It was actually 130 million light years away. So we're looking at what happened 130 million years ago of these two neutron stars, very dense objects, merging together and telling us that this is happening. And following that, all the telescope pointed at that event and detected it in light, which is the more typical way of studying astronomical events. But this time, this is the first time where we see both the gravitational waves, which tell us that the event is occurring indeed, not just like we think it's happening, it's for sure happening. And then we're seeing what happens after such two neutron stars are basically merging. For the first time, we are seeing what people have been predicting for decades.
Now, what I found intriguing, amongst other things, was that neutron stars are the hardest objects in the universe.
Mm-hmm. They are extremely dense objects. So, like I said, they're more massive than the sun. Their mass can range from one sun to a couple of suns. So they're a bit more massive than the sun. But the size is about the size of a city, about, you know, 10 to 15 kilometers radius. And so just imagine squeezing the sun into the size of a city. You get an extremely dense matter. And in fact, the densities are above nuclear densities. They even exceed the density of an atomic nucleus. And these are basically made of a sea of neutrons, which are some of the elementary particles. And these neutrons are under extreme pressures because of the extreme densities.
So now, what would have happened when they collided with each other? A black hole was created and they both went into the black hole.
Well, that's a very good and important and extremely puzzling question at the moment. Actually, that's what people are after, understanding what happened to this merging event. So we know it happened. We know it emitted light across the electromagnetic spectrum from radio to high energy radiation. But we still do not know if the merged event led to a neutron star, a heavy neutron star, or a light black hole.
A light black hole.
Right. So the two neutron stars' masses, when you combine them, obviously, so when you have two neutron stars merging, you expect to have an object about the size of the sum of the masses, right? So the first one had a mass between 1.2 to 1.4 solar masses, and the other one is somewhere between 1.4 and 1.6 solar masses. So they're both just above the mass of the sun. If you add them together, you get a total mass of 2.74 solar masses. That total mass could be the heaviest neutron star we know or the lightest black hole we know. And it's a very important question and a puzzle to solve in the years to come. Now, people tend to think at the moment that it's most likely to be a light black hole as opposed to two neutron stars. And the reason for that is because of the light we see. So I told you that this has been observed across the electromagnetic spectrum. In the infrared part of the electromagnetic spectrum, we are looking at the freshly synthesized heavy nuclei from this process, which made all these heavy elements like gold and platinum. And at the same time, in X-rays and in radio light, So in the opposite ends of the electromagnetic spectrum, we're seeing the result of the shock from the ejecta into the surrounding. And by just observing the behavior of the light in these wavelengths, people tend to believe that it's more likely to be a black hole rather than a neutron star. But this is something to be tested, I'm sure, in the many years to come.
And you mentioned that amongst the ejecta were these heavy nuclei like gold and titanium, and it had never been observed. You know, Burbage's theory about the triple alpha
process
and yes. how exploding stars just produced
right.
elements up to iron, and where do the heavier ones come
exactly.
from?
Exactly. Yeah.
Did people actually, astrophysicists, actually observe the presence of gold and titanium and
right.
other heavy elements bursting out of?
Right. So we do have various lines of evidence to say that these heavy elements are formed in supernovae, in fact. Supernovae, like I mentioned, if you have a massive star, as it goes through its life, it's going to die, and this death makes an explosion. So as the star is evolving, it makes elements heavier and heavier than hydrogen, partly with this triple alpha process, but it goes beyond that up to the point where iron is formed. So we know that massive stars can form elements up to iron. So the question is, what happens beyond iron, right? What makes the elements heavier than iron? So supernovae are really prime candidates or suspects for this, because during the explosion itself, the conditions are such that you have neutron-rich material that's going, and there it's extremely hot energetic environment where you can have this so-called R process, which is rapid neutron capture, which makes these really heavy elements. So that's one kind of suspect for making elements beyond heavier than iron, and that's what I keep telling my students. I personally am interested in supernovae and the remnants of these explosions, and we believe that they make some of these heavy elements. But another process that theorists have predicted make also the heavy elements is the neutron star mergers. So simulations show that if you merge two neutron stars, again, these are neutron-rich material, so obviously you have a lot of neutrons there, and so that collision is, again, extremely violent. It's going to help synthesize or form these very heavy neutron-rich materials, such as gold and platinum and the heavier elements. So, but this is the very first direct proof that these elements, in fact, were made in neutron star mergers. So, and in fact, the amount of elements made in that particular event has been measured precisely to be something like 6% the mass of the sun, which is enough to explain the heavy elements in the universe, according to the calculations by this recent discovery. So in principle, we can make them with supernovae and with neutron star mergers, but what we have now from this amazing event is the direct evidence that they are indeed formed, and in amounts that could explain the heavy elements that we have, at least in our galaxy, for example.
Now, a question that's intrigued me is, what is a black hole, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these things collided and may well have formed a black hole that they sank into.
Right.
If one were to go into a black hole,
right.
where would one end up?
Right. So it depends.
I mean,
how...
if you were, you know, had the correct equipment and suit,
right.
if you can imagine such a thing
right.
to protect yourself, and you went into a black hole, where would you end up?
Right. You don't want to do that, first of all, I would say. But it depends, you know, how far you are from the black hole. So we define black hole by what's called the event horizon. The event horizon is the distance from the black hole that tells you things will escape from there at a speed equal to the speed of light. So if you're within that radius, then nothing can escape, not even light. Nothing, absolutely nothing can escape from within that event horizon. If you're beyond that, then, you know, things will spiral around the black hole, and we believe they also make what's called an accretion disk, which is a very hot disc-like structure surrounding the black hole, and this thing shines in X-rays. And that's how we discovered black holes to start with. Back in the late 60s, black holes were discovered because they shine in X-rays because of this disc form spiraling around black holes. So I guess the answer to your question is you cannot get too close to the black hole or to within the event horizon because nothing will escape it. But beyond that, this is where the light is detected.
But so it is matter. A black hole is formed by matter. It has huge mass.
Right.
But if you were to go into it, you wouldn't come out on some other side in an alternative universe.
Right. And what we have here is an example of how a black hole is formed. You could form it by colliding two neutron stars, right? This is what we just discovered with gravitational waves LIGO event, is that we have one process that makes black holes. In this case, it's a very light black hole. But there are the black hole masses ranges from, you know, very light few solar masses all to millions and billions of solar masses. So we have supermassive black holes, which are at the center of some active galaxies. And here we have some, you know, very light black holes that result from the merging of neutron stars, for example.
Last question. Yeah. If this were to have happened closer to our solar system than 130 million light years away, if it had happened,
right.
If it were to happen, I don't know, closer, and Earth were to be bathed in this electromagnetic radiation and
exactly.
This pulse of, you know, ruffling of space-time, what effect would it have on life on Earth?
Well, I mean, first of all, if it were so close, then just the radiation that comes out of it, like this one was detected as a gamma ray burst, so there is a burst of gamma rays. The fact that it was 130 million light years away made the light diluted in the sense that it's not harmful to us, right? But you know that, and also it emitted X-rays, but we know that X-rays and gamma rays are very harmful to humanity, right? And so if this happens in our backyard, then definitely, just if you think of the heat and the X-ray and gamma ray radiation that's emitted, this is going to really be very harmful for us.
Samar Safi-Harb is a professor of physics and astronomy and a Canada research chair on extreme astrophysics at the University of Manitoba. Read more about Safi-Harb's research interests and GW170817 at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and YouTube, and our own home base, Blueberry. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. Shout out to CFMU listeners in Hamilton, Ontario, and CKUW fans in Winnipeg. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.